Thanks for all of those comments, and many of those were your views on the topics that have been discussed, and we appreciate those views. Among those comments, the one was, I think, a question, and that was the extent to which the recent standard on communications with audit committees, you know, had a linkage into this issue. And one of the proposals in that standard, one of the proposed requirements in that standard would be for the principal auditor to report to the audit committee about other auditors who are participating in the engagement so that the audit committee is aware of who all of the other, all the auditors are participating in an engagement. So that is a new requirement proposed in that standard. So it gets to the heart of at least, maybe the shareholders don't all know, but the audit committee would know, at least under the current environment, who all the auditors are. I would like to see if we could talk about this question a little bit. This is a slightly different question that was put up here by Dima. And then I'd like to put up the fourth question as well. So this one said, again, what information? Now we're talking about somebody has decided they're the principal auditor. What information about the qualifications of the other auditor should the standard require the principal auditor to obtain? How should those qualifications be evaluated? And the next question very close to that is, should those requirements for obtaining and evaluating the other auditor's qualifications be different if both auditors belong to the same network? If so, how should those qualifications be different? So somebody is the principal auditor, and other auditors are participating in the audit around the world. What should the principal auditor do to determine that those other auditors are qualified? And how does that differ whether or not they're part of a network or not? I wonder if there's any comments on that. There are some cards up, though, already.
Sorry, Mark, just to clarify your question, though, in the context of four, are you assuming that the principal auditor assumes responsibility for all of that work around the world, or is the principal auditor making reference to those other auditors?
Currently in AU 543, there are requirements that apply in either case. These requirements apply to both methods of reporting. And so same as these questions. So it's regardless of whether or not the reference is made. We are late for break. So the 10 cards that are up, we'll just go through these. And we'll get comments from Damon Silvers, Jim Schnur, Barbara Roper, and Lynn Turner, and then we'll have a break, if that's okay with you. Thanks. Damon Silvers.
My 10th card's been up through several different questions now, but it seems that, in fact, the underlying themes here seem continuous through those questions. What I would like to do is call the board's and the staff's attention back to Jim Cox's remark, where he's talked about the kind of dual identity of the network. When we were, several years ago, seems like much longer than that, but several years ago when we were, a number of us were working on the Treasury Department's advisory committee on the future of auditing, this question of the role of the network, I think, was a sort of fundamental conundrum. In terms of simply understanding the nature of the evolving, the way the profession was evolving and the way the structure of the profession in relation particularly to public companies was evolving. And I don't feel that we in that committee ever really came to a satisfactory kind of grappling with that. And I think there's some sort of fundamental basic data issues that that the board may want to think about here. Perhaps I missed it in the materials, but you know, I think sort of a baseline question is, to what extent, when we talk about the overall arranged set of problems associated with the principal and subordinate auditors, with the global challenges that Wayne was mentioning, to what extent are we talking about really a set of issues that in the typical public company are in-network issues, or to what extent are we talking about audit processes that are really that really represent firms in and out of network? And then, you know, I think the board ought to have a view frankly, on whether or not networks represent really managerial structures, or whether they represent, I don't know, mere branding. And I'm not sure that work's been done. I think that we then have substantively two underlying kinds of challenges here. And I think they're very serious. And I think that the board's and the staff's intention in raising this question before us is exactly right. The question of strengthening responsibilities for principal auditors and clarifying definitions here is a very important one. There are two risks. One is the risk that I came into this meeting thinking about, which is the set of risks sort of embodied by, for instance, Lehman Brothers, where there's the potential for issuers with the acquiescence or support of auditors to essentially run away from strong financial accounting and auditing scheme regimes, and then hide behind the weak side of the coin in terms of the network when challenged, but to run away from to places where there is at least the capacity. If you look at the relationship between the primary auditor and the secondary auditors, there's at least the capacity to understand each other, to be able to, there may be a failure of legal regime or a failure of management, but those failures exist against the potential for the oversight process and the audit process to work. What I hadn't thought about was what Wayne raised, which is the rising relevance of arrangements in which the information problems are far more profound, that the primary auditor simply doesn't have the capacity to do any kind of independent review of the quality of the work that's being done because it's being done in a language in which the primary auditor has no capacity. And it's layered on potentially by the possibility that there are governmental obstacles to getting that information, the view of the Chinese government, perhaps all the financial data of a parastatal entity is a state secret. I don't know if that is a fair enough description. But
these were not state-owned enterprises, the ones in question. And there's a large number of them, but none of them were the state-owned enterprises.
Right. But if you have one could have situations, particularly in that context, where the entity being audited is not state-owned, but there's a substantial interweaving of that entity's business with state-owned enterprises. I think that's a fairly common structure in China. It seems to me in those circumstances you've got a different problem. Right? It's overlaid on the problem of jurisdictions that don't allow the board in, don't allow our staff in to do inspections. But it seems to me that one of the clear lessons, at least I take away from Wayne's comment, is that what the board ought to be looking to here is some substantive standards on the principal auditor that you've got to have the capacity to be able to do a meaningful review of the work you're relying on. So that means that if you're going to be relying on, if you're auditing a firm that is conducting a large part of its business in Cantonese, you better have some people who understand that. That seems like a baseline kind of expectation on the firm that's signing the audit opinion. It seems to me you've got this sort of layered set of challenges here that I think are very significant, and that the board ought to really be digging into.
Thank you, Damon. Jim Schnur.
Just a couple of quick comments. First of all, with respect to the suggestion that we have consolidating financial statements and we disclose the auditors associated with each of those, components, I think there's a real danger of significantly increasing the expectation gap, because you have to remember that the opinion and the scope of the audit is on the consolidated financial statements. And the level of procedures that are performed at the components is based on that. And so, you know, you could go to a particular component and you may only be auditing inventory, and even at that location, you're doing it on a consolidated materiality. So I'd be very concerned about going down that path and significantly increasing the expectation gap. Going to the two questions, three and four, about the qualifications, I think that the things that you would need to consider would be the competency of the individuals that are actually performing the work, whether it be in network or out of network. I know through our experience with the inspection process, even in network, there is a significant focus on whether or not the people that are active, what assurance does the engagement team have about the level of competence with respect to the auditing standards that are being applied, which would be the PCOB auditing standards, U.S. GAAP knowledge with respect to the financial reporting and accounting. And so those are clearly the types of things that I think you would want to focus on. And in terms of whether it's in network or out of network, going back to the point I made earlier, you may be able to get more comfortable because you have a regime and network in place around certifications about the people that are providing performing the audit work at that location because they've attended certain training, as well as through a more holistic inspection process. Whereas out of network, you might have to do a lot more work to get comfortable with those types of qualifications.
Thank you for those comments. But I gather you're saying that even in network, the principal auditor, lead audit engagement partner, needs to understand the qualifications and evaluate the qualifications of the other auditors in other firms, even if they're part of the same network, except that maybe there's a facilitation of that by the overall organization in some fashion. Thanks.
Barbara Roper.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment very quickly on an issue, and perhaps it's appropriate to discuss in greater detail in some other context, because it's not specific to this standard, but the comment made earlier about the way that the PCAOB uses and relies on the works of other standard setters. This is an issue I'm very concerned about. I think it is absolutely essential that the PCAOB clearly describe its reasons for taking the position that it does. And if only because if you have to clearly describe why you're taking a particular approach, you have to clearly think about why you're taking that approach. And I certainly think it's appropriate for the PCAOB to consider all of the information that's available to it, including the information that's been gathered by other standard setters. But I actually think it's a very dangerous practice for the PCAOB to start down to create some impression that they have to justify differences between their standards and the standards that are adopted by the international standard setters, for example. And that it creates the impression that should be the starting point for how the PCAOB develops its own standards. And those of us who worked on Sarbanes-Oxley Act, actually worked very hard to ensure that the PCAOB would have this standard-setting authority and that it would be removed to a certain extent from excessive industry influence. It would be developed in a more independent process. And so I would just caution against this notion that the PCAOB has to create some kind of justification for divergence from any international standards or other standards any more than those entities feel any obligation to justify a difference from the PCAOB approach. You need to do what you think is best based on the best information you can gather from all the available sources.
Thank you. I appreciate that comment, and I want to say that that's the philosophy of the organization, that in standard setting, our goal is to create the best auditing standards that we can. So I appreciate the philosophy behind your statement. Having said that, there's a number of reasons why, since there are auditors and educators teaching students and auditors operating in multiple environments, we recognize the importance of at least explaining where it's different so that somebody can at least reference the fact that standard setter is this way, our standard is a different way, and we've articulated why we think our standard is different, but why we think it's better as well in that particular regard. But there's a lot of interest in this subject and a lot of views expressed on this, and I appreciate that comment of yours very much.
Last comment before the break. Lynn Turner, please.
I would echo what Barbara just said, and Marty, it is nice to have one set of standards. It makes it easier, but you have to avoid the, you know, you have to be running to the top rather than the rush to the bottom that we have going on in accounting standard settings. So I think you have to watch for that. I'd like to come back and just reiterate what Sam said. And I do think you have to start this whole process out with the notion of defining exactly what you want the primary auditor to be and then their responsibility. And then I think things will flow from that. I do agree wholeheartedly, Sam, that's a start, and you have to define who's going to control it and who's going to ensure that there is adequate evidence and who's responsible for all that. In theory, that should work, and it sounds good today, and in theory, that's the way the standard's supposed to work. The problem is that in practice, it just hasn't worked that way. We have seen things, and Jim Cox and some others have mentioned this. While we had a primary auditor, when things blow up, we all of a sudden find out we don't have a primary auditor. And all of a sudden, people who said we're the primary auditor of this instance are going into court and saying we don't have responsibility for doing that as long as we got an audit report from someone. That's the most we should have to do. And that's in the court records on cases like Parmalat. It's in the court records on what's going on with some of the Madoff feeder funds. So while there's a notion in theory that we have a primary auditor, in reality, when it gets down to it, there isn't one. And so that audit report to investors saying, I'm the one responsible for all of this, isn't true. And the attorneys sit there and support that notion in court as well they should as they try to defend them. So when you go back and define the primary auditor, if you're going to define someone as primary, I think you also have to define their obligation. And their obligation has to be that in good times as well as when things go wrong, they are in fact the primary auditor. And I think you ought to be including a statement in the report that they are the primary auditor and they are responsible for the financials taken as the audit of the financials taken as a whole. Not someone who's done some other piece, and cut it off, because if they're going to go in court and argue they aren't the primary auditor, there's no way they should be able to issue a report to the public saying that they are the primary auditor. I think you have to resolve that problem right up front before you can go any other place with this standard and resolve that issue. Otherwise, investors just will never have trust or credibility in those audit reports. Because we'll see one thing written and another thing done, and people aren't walking the talk. As far as the issue then with respect to looking at qualifications, I don't think, and what we've seen in the evidence in the Madoff case, is clearly people didn't even look at qualifications. This guy was a one-man shop, no peer review, no quality control. People just took the report, and since he signed it as CPA, they thought it was hunky-dorky, and that just doesn't work. I think you have to look at the qualifications as far as the QC, quality control in that firm, the inspection process within that firm, the competency of the people, including the competency to audit in the industry and the magnitude of the operations that are going to be delved into. But I think that's the starting point. Again, if you're the primary auditor and you're going to adopt that notion, then ultimately you're responsible for ensuring enough evidence was gained on everything. And that tells me if you're going to be the primary auditor, you have to go a lot further. You have to delve down into the audit plan. You have to delve down into the audit work that was actually done and the competency of the people that were doing it. So you have to greatly expand what is currently in the existing standard if you're really going to get down to ensuring that you are the person who's controlled the audit overall and you're the one that is ensured that there is enough evidence gained. And then, again, at the end, I would come back and be very transparent. I would come back. Gary was mentioning numbers change, but numbers don't change once they're in a financial statement. So at a point in time, we know what 50% of the assets were. We know what 50% of the revenues were. And we can figure out whether or not someone's done more than half or less than half. And I just don't understand how you tell the public, I'm the primary auditor, if you've done less than half of it. I appreciate what was said about risk, and I think risk does have to be brought into it. I think that's a very valid point. But at the end of the day, if you haven't even done half the audit, saying you're the primary auditor, and I have seen some of the Chinese situations, and they just simply amaze me when I see an auditor, as I recently did from Buffalo, New York, auditing, you know, a company over in China, and they don't speak the language, and they have no one in China. You know, and all of the operations are in China and no operations are in Buffalo, New York. You just got to wonder how that's allowed to be occur. So I would encourage you at the end of the day to be very transparent. Transparent in the report is exactly if this person is primary or not. With that, what their obligation is so that there can be no, when things go wrong, no backtracking from that notion. And then very transparent about how much the audit was done by those numbers was done by one party versus the other.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Just want to make sure that we, those of you who want to comment, have an opportunity to express your views on these two questions and the remaining questions that are very important to our standard setting process. So if you don't mind taking a shorter break, perhaps 20 minutes, and be back here for the second part of the discussion, would appreciate that. Thank you.
Back at 11:15.
11:15. Thank yes, you. Thanks. We can start making our way back to our seats. That'd be great. Thank you.
Good morning. We're ready to begin the second part of the principal auditor discussion, if everyone can take their seats. Thank you.
Welcome back, and we're going to resume our discussion of the responsibilities of the principal auditor. Before the break, we talked about the decision to become the principal auditor and some of the procedures that are required, whether or not the principal auditor makes reference to the report of the other auditor. Now let's talk about the procedures that are required when the principal auditor assumes responsibility for the work of the other auditor. Under AU 543, the principal auditor must obtain and review certain specific information from the other auditor, and he or she should also consider performing other procedures such as visiting the other auditor and reviewing certain documentation. AU 543 does not specify the factors that the principal auditor should consider in determining the extent of these procedures, these other procedures, or whether to perform these other procedures at all. In a briefing paper, we suggested that in a new standard, certain procedures could always be required when the principal auditor assumes responsibility. And also suggested an approach according to which there may be certain additional procedures that are necessary if the level of risk associated with the work that the other auditor performs increases, or the competence, level of competence, and it's a relative sort of determination, the level of competence of the other auditor decreases. So let me introduce these two questions, 5 and 6. One relates to the procedures that would always be required. The other one talks about this approach that we suggested in the briefing paper. So the first question is, what specific direction should a new standard provide to determine the necessary extent of the principal auditor's involvement in the work of the other auditor in order to assume responsibility for that work? The second question is, would it be appropriate to establish the scope and extent of additional procedures to be performed by the principal auditor based on the risk associated with the area audited by the other auditor and the competency of the other auditor? With that, let's take your comments. Thanks. Galen Hansen.
Yeah, it would seem to me that with respect to question number five, you would always have to expect and demand independence. So that's something that would have to be confirmed up front and independent of each other's clients. Also, I think in a principal auditor situation, the principal auditor always needs to be involved in determining the scope of the work. The risk assessment as it relates to the other component that's being audited and the materiality. So I think that that involvement has to be there. And to some level, there needs to be a level of supervision.
Thank you. And I apologize. My Gallagher's tin card was up before lunch. So, Mike.
Thank you. It sort of relates to these questions, and it's really a question of Wayne. Wayne mentioned the egregious anecdotal example in China, and just listening to that, I mean, that certainly seems indefensible that you've got 100% of the audit done by somebody else, and yet somebody else is the principal auditor. I guess the question is this something that we need standard setting for, or couldn't we do something under the existing standards relative to enforcement? Because it just seems so obvious that that's just egregious, and you wonder whether under the existing standards due professional care, and I'm sure there's a bunch of other existing principles under rules that exist today, and isn't this more about enforcement?
A similar question came up earlier, and I did say that we felt that we had the ability to enforce existing requirements under 543 and to bring actions under egregious situations like that. But having said that, one still looks at 543 and wonders, could the standard be improved? Could the requirements be improved in the determination of principal auditor? Could the requirements be improved in when reference has to be made or not as to who the other auditors are? And could the requirements be improved with respect to this question about specific direction to determine the extent of the auditor's involvement in the work of the other auditor? So I do agree with you that existing enforcement can take care of egregious situations, but still what we're asking the SAG is, should the standard provide, improved direction and improved requirements notwithstanding that?
Yeah, Marnie, and I get that. And my only concern was that, egregious circumstances that may perhaps be a little bit unique and having that be the premise on which the standards change is my concern. That said, I would agree that there's always room for improvement. And I guess more to the point of these specific questions, I guess I would be more for, and I think Doug mentioned it earlier, more towards, because there is so much judgment, there's so much subjectivity in this, bright line rules can actually work against this sometimes. And I think having additional considerations that, an auditor should think about before making a decision, on the qualitative side in particular, I think it is very useful. I do have concerns about bright lines, so I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Wayne Collins.
Yeah, I think the overall direction, I think, is outlined fairly well in ISIS 600, and seems to follow the approach that's set forth in the paper here, which is that the principal auditor needs to get an understanding and be able to address the risks of material misstatement. What did the audit teams around the world do to the extent of risk of material misstatement? So that means the principal auditor needs to understand the businesses, needs to understand the susceptibility of those businesses to risk, needs to discuss that with the other audit teams, needs to be involved in the planning part of the engagement for identifying what the significant risks are and the component parts of the group, and then needs to be able to review documentation of how the significant risks were actually addressed by the audit teams. And I think that kind of an approach, should go a long way to enhancing the principal auditor's involvement on the engagement.
Wayne Carnell.
Thank you. Yes, actually, maybe just to quickly address Mike's observations, and I would certainly agree that when you look at the spectrum of the issues that we have seen, there are some that are clearly more egregious and more concerning than others, but there is a wide spectrum of what we have experienced, again, just even focusing just on the China issue, for which I do think some of the standard-setting process could clarify and help improve the process, because some of it is, while you can look at it as being egregious, I think some people argue that they are actually complying with the standards, and it really gets back to they will argue they are the principal auditor. They are having some sort of supervision capability. And again, you can question what they are actually doing in practice. But I do think that this rule, I think it's great that this issue is being addressed. Just simply relying on enforcement to solve this issue, this is not an isolated one or two companies. This involves, I would say, hundreds of companies. So it's enforcement would be a massive process in that regard. And just one related item, if I throw out as perhaps as a possibility of a related question to the questions that you're asking, is should the other auditor be required to be registered with the PCAOB? And again, some of these situations where we have seen either the other auditor or the staff performing the work be part of a firm that is registered with the PCAOB, because some of the situations we have seen, obviously, they involve people that are performing audit procedures that are not a member of any firm that is registered with the PCAOB, albeit you'll still have issues about being able to do an inspection.
Thank you. Larry Sella?
I'd echo Wayne Collins' comments about ISA 600, although, you know, he and probably others around the table are more familiar with the specific provisions of it, but it sounds to me like that is a standard that's being written to create performance standards to achieve specific objectives, and that's what I think we need to focus on here is because I'm realizing that the question has come up, is this standard one that will be complied with by a firm or by an engagement signing partner? And, you know, when you look at the situations that, you know, have been cited here, I'm surmising that the firm in Buffalo or the firm that signed off, you know, in China may very well be a one- or two-person firm. And this standard has to be complied with by the CPA that is signing the opinion. So it needs to be read from that perspective. Then how does that CPA get comfortable that either all components of the audit have been adequately performed so such that they can take responsibility, whether they name other component auditors or not, whether that be another firm within their network, another office within their firm, or an unaffiliated firm, they still need to comply with a performance standard. And I realize the difficulty. My perspective, I think, coming into this meeting was thinking more in terms of larger firms naming firms, unaffiliated firms in other parts of the world or even domestically, but, you know, for components of the audit, not really kind of appreciating the meld between the affiliated, the network issue with this issue. And I can see now that the you know, some of the comments coming up about when this gets into litigation, some of the large firms may have said, hey, that's not my firm. It's my affiliated firm. This performance standard has to be complied with by any engagement partner. If you write the standard from that perspective that they have to achieve these objectives and write the performance standards for them, it should work for whether it's another inter-office engagement, an affiliated firm within a network, which is, to my knowledge, not well defined, or another firm. And this issue of divided responsibility may very well perhaps be unique to the U.S. regime, where if you name the other firm, it gives you a higher level of defense in terms of dividing responsibility. Perhaps that's, I don't know why, if it's the case, but perhaps that's why that's not a high priority in ISIS 600 because of different litigation regimes around the country, around the world.
Thank you, Larry. And Larry brought up a good point that our standard would not discriminate against either an affiliation of a firm or size of the firm, for example. It would equally apply to large firms or small firms within or outside the network. And let's take a look again at question five. What we're asking you here to comment on is what should be sort of a minimum set of requirements, if you will, that would apply in these varying circumstances, whether it be a large firm network and there are sort of group auditor situations that are described in ISA 600, or there be situations like the ones that Wayne Carnell refer to, where there is a firm in China and there are smaller firms and one of them does 90% of the work. So there are so many different variations of this principal auditor versus the other auditor scenario that we have to deal with that makes the question we have put up kind of tricky. So what specific direction should we provide to all of these different auditors? And then we can move on into the next one where we think about what additional requirements might be necessary. I know Arnold's card been up, so please.
Thank you. A couple of observations, also a reaction to previous comments. And I do not want to, let's say, to advertise or advocate ISA 600, but it's obvious that ISA 600 tried to answer many of the questions that we are now dealing with. But I think it's very important to understand the main direction of ISA 600, and that starts with the objective, which reads first: the objectives of the auditor are A, to determine whether to act as the auditor of the group financial statements, and if acting, then etc. So it's already focusing on the very important decisions: am I able and do I want to act as? If the answer will be yes, then the requirements start to focus, as some have mentioned, with the responsibility of the group engagement partner. So there's a very specific person that has to take on this responsibility for both the direction, supervision and performance of the group audit, but also, and that's another requirement, that the group engagement partner shall determine whether sufficient appropriate audit evidence can reasonably be expected, etc. And then immediately after that, there is another requirement: if the group engagement partner concludes that it will not be possible for the group engagement team to obtain that sufficient evidence, then it's either not accepting or withdrawing. So again, it focuses on you should very well know what you're doing and what you are accepting. And I haven't heard the word behavior literally, but in some comments it was very clearly reflected. This was the main thrust, as I understand it, from the many discussions when drafting ISA 600, to stimulate appropriate professional behavior of the group engagement partner and his whole team. And that's throughout other requirements. So there is, of course, requirements on understanding the component auditor, among others, to obtain an understanding on whether the group engagement team will be able to be involved in the work of the component auditor to the extent necessary to obtain that evidence, to be involved. Not sure whether you can be involved if you are not doing any of the work and do not understand any of the language. But it poses the clear questions on that responsibility that you're assuming. But it's not also stimulating the behavior of the auditor, but also of its client. And I was reminded by that on a comment that Gary made. In the example, for example, of equity investees, there's also a role of top management and the board to make it possible that auditors have access to those investees. And ISA 600 became effective, well, let's say, beginning of this year. So currently, the firms are implementing it and gaining experience. And we, of course, at the board are very interested whether it's all right, whether it's working. And when Sam mentioned this working group, actually we as IAASB not have a working group, but there is a working group of the networks, the former firms. And in particular, they are trying to understand whether there are specific problems with implementing 600. And we, of course, are very interested in learning from that. And Marty, I would suggest that it would be helpful for both the PCAOB and the IAASB to understand the findings from that working group and to see to what action that might result, if any. I was intrigued by the comments on disclosures from the investors, and I asked a bit about around. I can understand questions from investors that they would like to understand how the audit has been organized throughout the world. I feel you have to have an understanding of what then would investors do about that, and it would be helpful to have a bit of an understanding what action investors would take or what kind of analyses, etc. But in the meantime, some mentioned the audit committees, and you among others did so. I think that's a very important point, and it's a while ago that I was in practice, but I very well remember audit committees that were really taking a very great interest in understanding how the audit globally was organized and how the relationship with component auditors was and if that was of sufficient quality, etc. So I think that's very important. And finally, if you allow me a comment on the best standards and explaining differences. Of course, the PCAOB has its mandate. We have our mandate. But we have, I think, the same ambition of creating the best standards. And if you take this ISA 600, it went through various rounds of exposure drafts. Actually, there were three of them, 2003, 2005, 2006, before it came to the final standard. So at least all that effort with global input several times has been incorporated in that. And as I said, we are now trying to understand whether it's working and whether it needs maybe improvement or further clarification. But at least it had the ambition behind it to be a very good standard. And I would be really glad to share any experiences that we encounter during this process, Marty. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Arnold. And we are glad to get the benefit of the working group to see how ISA 600 is working. And as I mentioned earlier, although we have a responsibility to develop our own standards, certainly we're looking at ISA 600 and understanding how well that's working would be important to us. So thanks in that regard. In response to a comment Wayne just made earlier, should the other auditor in the situations we talked about have to be registered with the PCAOB, we have a rule with respect to other auditors performing a substantial role as defined. So if the other auditor is performing a substantial role, a defined term and a defined measure of participation in the audit, then they do have to be registered with the PCAOB and therefore subject to inspection. But as some have mentioned earlier, in certain countries and certain markets, we're unable to carry out those inspections right now. Lynn?
I think this question does get back to somewhat the issue of the primary auditor. I think it's very hard unless you actually go do the audit work in some of these situations to really gather the evidence necessary to say you audited. You really are relying upon that other auditor a fair amount. And it's probably why I actually would have divided responsibility and clarify that in the report that firm A is, you know, auditing these amount and is auditing the disclosures in the financial statements, et cetera. Auditor B has audited 20% of the assets and revenues, and I would have it say something to that, and I would have the legal liability then run to their respective pieces. And so from my perspective, I actually think it works better if you have that divided responsibility and divided legal liability when you put that firm in the position of being the primary auditor. Now, they are legally liable for all the whole thing, and I'm not sure, you know, I just don't think it, realistically they can go without doing the audit work and do it. If you're going to say, though, we're going to retain the primary auditor, then when you get down to this particular question, I think you have to put in an overarching objective here of that auditor does have to do what's necessary to ensure, you know, that gas was complied with and, you know, the necessary information was, in fact, gathered. And with that, then, you really have to go back to saying that primary auditor has to be involved with the planning. They have to understand the supervision. And ultimately, an audit's only as good as the people doing the audit. So you have to have that primary auditor get down into the qualifications and the competency of the people actually doing the audit. And I don't think you can do that without, you know, getting the necessary information to figure out just how good these people are, whether they're competent in the industry, whether they've had adequate training in the industry and really know the industry well, so they know what risk and all to look at. You certainly have to get through the audit program, and then you have to get through the work papers, and you may have to decide if there's a high-risk area there that perhaps you have to go out and look further. If there's a big impairment or something, maybe you got to go beyond that. But ultimately, you're going to have to say, as primary auditor, you got the ultimate obligation and responsibility to make sure that there's adequate evidence. And I think that's very difficult, and I think that's why ultimately I would actually have the divided responsibility and the divided liability.
Lynn, can I follow up with a question? Would okay.
Go ahead, Marty.
Can you reconsider? Would do your and thank you for those comments. I think they're very helpful. In making those comments about the requirements of the primary auditor to get involved in the planning and the supervision and understand the planning and supervision and qualifications and competencies of the other auditor, do you see a distinction in your mind of whether or not those other auditors are part of a network firm or not? Do you see any distinction?
I think, yeah, I do see a distinction, you know, and maybe I'm not wrong on this, but I think when you are, based on my experience, when you're part of a network firm, there are things that those firms, especially the larger firms, do to deal with some of that competency and some of that training issues. Doesn't mean you're totally absolved. I probably would still put in the same criteria. I probably wouldn't change the criteria between whether you're in network or out of network. But I think if you're in network as a matter, as a practical matter, it's going to be much easier for you to get through those issues than if you are out of network. And it really doesn't matter. Again, it's who's doing the work and the quality of the work they're doing. So it doesn't matter whether it's your affiliate in Germany or an unaffiliated firm over in Germany, you still need to know the same basic thing because you still need to get the evidence. It's just that if you're in network, it's probably going to be a lot easier to get through and make sure you've complied with that just the way you set up your networks and you've got consistent audit manuals and expectations and you have quality control already set up. So I think I keep the same criteria. Wouldn't differentiate, but then it's up to the firm just to make sure, regardless whether it's in or out of network, that they've taken care of those things.
Thank you. And Jim Schnur, I think that's consistent with what I heard you say before as well, that the requirements would be the same for the other auditor, whether they're in network or out of network, except that the network might facilitate, as Lynn said, the ability of the primary auditor to get some of that information. Is that your view?
That's correct, Marty. Yeah.
Steve Rafferty, please.
I'd like to follow on to this network notion. I think I sort of agree with what's being said, although if I were writing a standard, I would talk about the existence of common control procedures, common quality control processes, inspection processes, and those things. And I might steer clear away from the notion of even using the word network, because it is extremely easy to fall within the international definition of a network by doing no more than sharing a common brand name. And I think to the question of what specific direction should be provided, my point would be that I don't think you can give specific direction because you have no specific set of circumstances that are going to exist in these multinational audits. You have some circumstances where you do, in fact, use a quote-unquote network firm that shares quality control processes and inspection, and you know a tremendous amount about the way their work is going to be done, and you have other circumstances where you might have even a network firm that you know absolutely nothing about their quality control processes. So to say that you could provide specific direction, I think, would be almost an impossibility. And I think I would, again, be extremely careful with the whole notion of a network in this standard, because I think it could create a fair amount of confusion around the world for firms that are in, quote-unquote, networks that are no more than branding mechanisms. And I think if I were writing a standard, I'd kind of step back from the questions of, is there guidance needed to serve on determining whether you can serve as a principal auditor or what these procedures ought to be to ensure the quality of the work that's being done by the other firms? I would probably step back and say, what have we found in inspection, and what problem are we trying to resolve? I think that's going to be the best source of what needs to be fixed here, as opposed to asking a lot of sort of general questions about what's going on in the world. You folks have an excellent idea of what the deficiencies are from the inspection process, and I would probably take a more rifle shot approach at that. And finally, I did want to comment on the notion of the sort of egregious violations like these Chinese examples. I tend to believe as well that is probably more of an enforcement issue than anything else. And while it might be possible to write a standard to make it clearer that that's a violation, it's pretty obvious that that's a violation of the existing standard. And if we want to have principles-based standards, we're going to have to be able to resolve in this country egregious violations like that with enforcement, or we're headed right back to rules-based standards where we write very finite rules so we can say, black and white, that's a violation of the rule. So I think we've got to find a way for enforcement to resolve those issues, or we're going to end up with the very detailed rules that everyone's arguing that we don't want.